This podcast has spent quite a lot of time in Europe lately. I feel like we're approaching dangerously close to a tired, Eurocentric perspective. Too many histories of world civilization end up being a history of Western civilization, and I'm hoping to avoid that in future episodes, as we backtrack and dance around the timeline a bit, like always, to fully explore the whole world, laying the foundations for likely the most significant culinary event in history. For now, though, I feel momentum building in the last episode with what went down in the late Middle Ages, with the lots of peasants and a new middle class greatly improved, and diets and civil society turned upside down. I've decided to stay with the story thread I started for once, and directly follow through on what happened next. So, without further ado, okay, with a little ado, let's talk the Italian Renaissance. I'm the Anthro Chef, and even though I have always loved to learn about the Italian Renaissance, about all its cultural and artistic and culinary achievements, and the rebirth of Europe, I'll just come right out and say right away that too much gravitas is given to the whole thing. Europe was not suddenly reborn in the 15th and 16th centuries. It had been a long, steady climb over hundreds of years, with other Renaissance-type events occurring beforehand. We'll also later touch on how what I call the capital R Renaissance in Italy only affected relatively few people. In fact, it didn't even affect the majority of the population. Despite the Sistine Chapels, the births of Venuses, and the freaking everything Da Vinci did, in reality, the day-to-day life for your average Giuseppe continued unchanged and uninterrupted. The Renaissance was really more of a richissance. Nonetheless, there are reasons it's important to know about. As I hinted at in the intro, what happens here will be very important to what happens in future episodes. So, just briefly, before we dig into all the details, what was the European Renaissance? It was all driven by a revolution in thought, thanks to the intellectual engine of rediscovering Greek and Roman texts. The most significant changes that emerged were in architecture, art, literature, music, philosophy, politics, science, and even religion too. The emergence of humanism as the prevailing outlook is what resonates the most with me. Even though we give too much import to this supposed historical event, it's hard not to perceive it that way, as the higher minds of Europe really do seem to wake up in what began in Italy as early as the 1300s, and eventually spread to all of the continent by the 15s. I won't get too far ahead of myself yet, but all of this would pave the way for the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution to come. We'll also see that the Renaissance is when the types of Italian food we know and love today start to become more familiar. Here's the thing, though. We covered the buildup in Europe last episode, but that's not the whole story on how this fascinating time period began. I told you I wouldn't be satisfied sticking with the Western European story for so long. So this is actually going to be a lot of stories, and I hope you're ready for some hopping around through time and locales to try and paint a full picture of this era we call the Renaissance. To begin, we have to backtrack and learn about the Byzantines. But actually, to learn about the Byzantines, we should probably first talk about what the Muslims have been up to. From our Eurocentric perspective of late, we've seen the great Islamic caliphates peeking in at the fringes of Africa and the Middle East as a looming giant, actually occupying and influencing much of the European continent in their wake. They took over the Spanish Peninsula, invaded Sicily and mainland Europe back in Charlemagne's grandpa's day, and more lately had been struggling over the Holy Land during the Crusades of the High Middle Ages. We haven't really looked at the other side, though, from the Muslim perspective, since episode 14. Remember, the enormous caliphates of the Islamic Empire did not share Europe's Dark Age. In fact, the Umayyad, which gave way to the Abbasid and later the Fatimid and Ottoman caliphates, really presided over the opposite, more of a golden age of philosophy, learning, science, and cultural flourishing. Sound familiar? The roots of the Italian Renaissance surely connect to the Muslims, whose connection and preservation of classical Greek and Roman works would eventually make the whole thing possible. Because without Islamic scholars copying them down, many of those old works would have been lost to history. And try to imagine an early modern Europe without the works of Aristotle and all the others. Yeah, I thought so. One major culinary development that I have plans to tackle in detail in future episodes, but is worth mentioning in passing here, is distillation, introduced to Europe by the Arabs in the early Middle Ages. Distillation is the process of boiling and then condensing a liquid to separate its components and bring it down to its purest essences. Distilled water had been known for centuries, but Arabic glassware technology allowed new consumables like rose and flower water, a very popular ingredient in late medieval cuisine, and then, of course, hard liquor, whiskey, vodka, rum. It's hard to imagine Europeans without them. But even the word alcohol is an Arabic word. Again, I have a lot more to say about distilled beverages, but that's for another time. Being at the crossroads of the Silk Road and connected directly to Asia, the Islamic Empire was a hotbed of knowledge and new ideas. And Europe, by proximity, was exposed to these same things via the Crusades. Like we covered in depth last time, Muslim territory was also a crossroads of cuisine, bringing in culinary techniques and ingredients from all directions to one place, where they could mix and then spread out to new lands. Soon there were Muslims living in and controlling most of Spain, Sicily, and parts of Italy and Eastern Europe by the 8th century. As these new masters of the Mediterranean pushed their territory into Europe, they were forced to adapt to its climate. They introduced new plants and techniques and technologies like the water wheel, and improved field organization and irrigation. In meeting the challenges of these new climates, Islamic farming productivity flourished. Where the Lombard and the Visigoth and other Dark Age kingdoms previously occupying these lands made little effort to improve their yields, under the Arabs, there was a farming revolution. Sicily and Al-Andalus, or Muslim Spain, were transformed into agricultural paradises, endless groves of olive and pomegranate and all kinds of other trees, and fields of crops still dominating those landscapes today. Wait a second. All of this sounds a lot like the so-called European agricultural revolution we talked about in the Dark Ages episode. That's right, all those innovations we gave Europe credit for are likely more a result of Islamic influence. Look, sorry, not sorry, European nationalists, there is just no getting around it. The Muslims are responsible for much of the foundations of European culture. The world is not as subdivided and independent as people want to believe, okay? It's all mixed up together. The Muslim influence on regional Italian cuisine may have been most pronounced of all. Rice, arancini or stuffed rice balls, and the rich stew of eggplant and olive oil caponata, which is still everywhere in Italian cuisine, likely descend from the cuisine of the Arabs. One of the biggest influences on Italian food was a revival of durum wheat, which thrived in the Italian climate better than just about anywhere else. This hard wheat had been used sparingly across ancient cultures, but its cultivation was intensified by Arabs in East Africa in the 8th century. They originally cracked the wheat berries to make couscous, which found some popularity in Europe as well. But wouldn't you know it, you also need durum wheat if you're going to make pasta. That's right, you knew it had to come up in an episode about Italian food. Let's talk about the origins of European pasta. There's actually evidence of a kind of pasta made as far back as ancient Rome. Made from durum wheat, and even called an early version of the word lasagna, a kind of pasta-like dough was rolled out and layered with filling. That's about where the similarities end, though. The dough was not boiled, but oven-baked, resulting in what would have been more of a pastry than a true lasagna today. In the end, don't let any Italians tell you that ancient Romans invented pasta, though there were some similarities. It's just not accurate. The Italian peninsula would have to wait a few more centuries for its most popular dish to make a further culinary leap forward. Another popular myth is that Marco Polo discovered noodles in China and brought them back to his homeland of Italy. And while it's true that the original pasta was invented in China, see episode 9, it had already been brought to Europe by Muslims centuries before Polo was born. Today, the presence of Arabic people in the south of the peninsula during the early Middle Ages is considered the most likely reason behind the diffusion of pasta. One major hint to this fact is that while medieval cooks did add plenty of pasta-ish things, like herbs, butter, and cheese, more Middle Eastern ingredients were actually more popular for pasta dishes. Things like raisins, cinnamons, and even sweetness from dried fruits and sugar, proving the Arabic influence of the ingredient. By the 1300s, dried pasta was very popular in Italy. By 1400, it was being produced commercially. As any experienced cook knows, a good pasta dough requires a lot of kneading to get the right glutinous texture. Back in medieval times, pasta was kneaded by foot, with men trotting on it for a day or more to make a proper dough, which then had to be rolled under great mechanical pressure as well. The modern word macaroni derives from the Sicilian term for kneading dough with energy, as early pasta making was often a laborious, day-long process. When we get back to the specifics of Italian Renaissance cuisine, we'll talk more about the kinds of pasta dishes popular back then. But for now, I just want you to take away that it was almost an entirely Arab influence. So let's get back to that broader historical story. While a blessing for culture and cuisine, the Muslims' direct connection to the East proved to be a double-edged sword. Or a double-tipped horse archer, I guess. I'm definitely mixing metaphors at this point. Anyway, a lot of the splendor and the power of the Islamic Empire was laid low when the Mongols invaded from the east and tore a swath of destruction through the region, putting an end to the Abbasid era and the Islamic Golden Age as a whole. Some scholars assert that this disaster, combined with the devastation of the Black Death, is why the Eastern world never fully recovered, and that this multi-disaster marks the shift in power to the West, which will shape the modern world as we know it and live in today. Back then, the world just kept turning, however. As they did in China, the Mongols assimilated themselves into Islamic culture. There were Mongol caliphs, but ultimately, a huge power vacuum had been opened. Enter the Ottomans. The Ottoman Turks, to be more precise. We haven't really talked about Turkic peoples much yet on this podcast, but they've been kicking around Central Asia as nomad horsemen since at least 200 BC. This is before Anatolia, or what we call Turkey today, was their official homeland. Made up of their own clans and ethnic groups, Turks were well accomplished in battle, and as a whole, slowly accumulated power and territory across Europe and Asia over the centuries. Turks would eventually take on sedentary life and civilization, culminating in the Seljuk Empire of the High Middle Ages, which at its peak controlled modern-day Afghanistan, Iran, and the entire Levant. The importance of food in Turkish culture is hard to dispute. Look at the architecture of the Sultan's palaces, containing huge kitchens which spanned multiple buildings. More than 1,000 kitchen staff could be retained and put up in these places. Hundreds of cooks specializing in different categories like soup, pilafs, kebabs, veggies, seafood, pastry, baking, and sweets, feeding sometimes 10,000 people a day. Following the example of the palace, all of the Grand Ottoman houses boasted their own elaborate setups and competed in throwing feasts. In each neighborhood, a very strong tradition of hospitality emerged in Turkish culture, and this is how the traditional cuisine evolved, fused, and spread. You can also look at the structure of the military, the elite janissaries, the central pillar to Ottoman society. Commanders of divisions were literally called soup men, and other officers were nicknamed chief cook, baker, and pancake maker. Their actual functions had nothing to do with these titles, but that only reinforces to me that those occupations had weight and importance. Such food-based metaphors were also central to politics, where knocking over the grain pilaf cauldron, deliberately spilling food, meant a demand for change. Overturning the cauldron is still a Turkish expression today, which means rebellion in the ranks. What was ancient Turkish food like? Well, the Turks, like the Muslim empires generally, controlled territory that had the same privilege, being at the crossroads of the Far East and the Mediterranean, and that brings wealth in trade and ingredients. It was in this setting that the chefs of the sultans developed and helped spread traditional Turkish food, which took on all kinds of regional styles as it made its way around the empire. But as Turkish power and availability of ingredients increased, culinary attitudes and preferences actually remained consistent, largely intact, from early nomadic days through Seljuk times carrying over to Ottoman culture. After two centuries of prosperity, Seljuk Turkish power, which had dominated the Middle Ages, suffered a decline, along with the other Muslim empires during and after the Mongol invasion. As they often do across history, the Turks split back up again, into different factions and territories, none terribly much more powerful than the other. But soon, a new Turkish dynasty, called the Ottomans, was on the rise, thanks to their exploitation of gunpowder and cannons. Their founder, Sultan Osman I, led a series of campaigns against the Eastern Roman Empire, winning several major battles, capturing several cities of Eastern Christendom, and thus pushing into Europe and the Balkans. The Ottoman naval fleet was expanded into overdrive mode, to the point where they could challenge Venice, the preeminent naval power of the day. Soon, the city of Constantinople, once the jewel of Eastern Rome and the greatest city of its day, was all but surrounded by Ottoman territory, under siege and barely hanging on. And this was not even the height of Ottoman Turkish power. Their story extends far beyond the scope of this episode, as they reach their peak and loom over Europe like a sword of Damocles during the 16th and 17th centuries. For now, I have to pause their story, though, and get back to reestablishing the Renaissance. With the Ottomans at the gates of Constantinople, we're almost there. But please, backtrack with me one more time, at least for today. We need to talk about the Byzantines, aka the people who lived in Constantinople, aka the Eastern Roman Empire, which had endured another 1,000 years after the fragmentation and fall of Rome in the West. During the earlier Middle Ages, way back in just the hundreds AD, before Charlemagne and his friends brought light back to Europe, the Eastern Roman Empire, now dubbed the Byzantine Empire and the Greek Orthodox Christian Church, was a powerful heavyweight on the world stage. At its height, under the famous Emperor Justinian in 555 AD, the successors of Eastern Rome controlled modern-day Turkey, the Levant, North Africa, Greece, Italy, and even parts of Spain, basically the whole Mediterranean. And with Western Europe split up in political anarchy during the Dark Ages, Byzantium was like the model, older sibling that was more attractive and somehow had its life together, looming over everything that happened in the West. People living under the early Byzantine Empire saw themselves as Romans, but the culture did slowly change over its lifetime. As it incorporated more Greek and Christian aspects, it transformed into a uniquely Byzantine culture, shaped by influences from Armenian and Persian peoples too. Later on, it was influenced by the Islamic empires as a whole. Like the Roman Empire of old, Constantinople itself was an extremely diverse and thriving metropolis. Its residents were multi-ethnic and multi-religious. Trade so flourished there because taxes for foreign merchants were the same as for residents, which was pretty unique for the time. In addition to dominating the Mediterranean, Byzantine traders had routes as far as into the Black Sea, the Red Sea, and even pushing into the Indian Ocean. Yes, in the early Middle Ages, nobody could touch the power of Byzantium. But over the next 1,000 years, that was going to change dramatically, but slowly, a trickling decline over centuries. Byzantine success brought them right up against the rising Islamic empires, who through multiple wars and conquests would chip away at Eastern Rome until it was a husk of its former self, just one more territory for the growing caliphates to acquire. Pretty much every single Muslim territorial gain came at the Byzantines' expense. The Safavids, the Turks, the Mongols, everybody took a piece. But before we get any further into how the Byzantine Empire declined, collapsed, and eventually fell, shaping the future of the European Renaissance, let's give the Byzantines their due and talk about what their food was like a little, since we so skipped that topic in earlier episodes. Unlike Europe in the Dark Ages, trade in Byzantium continued mostly uninterrupted and on schedule, having access to ingredients from all over the Old World. Despite those influences, Byzantine cuisine was characterized mostly by a melding of both Greek and Roman gastronomy. Not exactly a surprise. Two major styles emerged in the process. You had the Eastern Byzantine style, more in the Roman vein of experimenting with trade items like spices, sugar, and exotic meats and veggies. Very medieval, almost. Actually, though clearly descended from Rome, too. This style of cooking was considered haughtier, only for those rich enough to be connected with world trade. To counteract it, a simpler, leaner style, based on local Greek cuisine, also flourished. Commoners ate more conservatively. The usual old world staples of bread, veggies, pulses, soups, stews, and salads prepared in various ways. Lower and middle class folks in the cities usually ate at the taverna, where a good boiled dinner was always available. Actually, boiled bar food was so ubiquitous that it inspired a famous Byzantine cooking maxim. That is, the lazy cook prepares everything by boiling. Cooks vilifying boiled food. Some things never change. Most people got to eat poultry or fowl, at least sometimes. Also, seafood and shellfish was of course enjoyed across classes, particularly in the form of gyros, or fish sauce, the Greek version of gyrum. To go with it, there was also a kind of Byzantine version of soy sauce called mouri, which was made out of barley instead of soybeans, perhaps diffused from China. Eggs were also extremely popular across meals, particularly omelets, known as sponges at the time. The Byzantines also produced various cheeses, some of which are still very popular in Greek cuisine today, such as kefalotyri. Thanks to the location of Constantinople between popular trade routes, Byzantine cuisine was augmented by cultural influences from several locales. The resulting melting pot affected much of the Mediterranean Sea and continued during Ottoman times. Therefore, modern Turkish food, Greek food, and Balkan food are all very similar in a lot of ways, thanks to Byzantine hegemony in the early Middle Ages. Though, don't tell any of the people living there that they have to share credit for inventing baklava. Looking outside, however, it's hard to deny that all those cultures share a very wide range of ingredients, techniques, and dishes, having shaped and influenced each other over the centuries through a unified cuisine. Hold on. Didn't I say that it was the Muslims who benefited from being on trade routes? We're suffering a bit from my goofy chronology here. Remember, the Byzantines were the most powerful state in late antiquity, before Islam was yet conceived as a religion. Once Muhammad's Arab Empire rose in the 7th century, however, the Coptic writing was on the wall for the Byzantines, as all of their prized territories fell one by one to the Muslims. They lost their richest provinces of Egypt and Syria almost right away to the Sassanids. Still a powerful empire, though, the Byzantines briefly got back on their feet before the crusading years. But then the Seljuk Turks came in and conquered much of Anatolia from them, which now seems finally appropriate to call Turkey. There were many battles and it was a long struggle, but ultimately, the Byzantines were always losing ground. Perhaps the fatal blow, though, came from treachery, stabbed in the back by their Roman Catholic neighbors, just crusading through from the west and sacking Constantinople in 1204. After that, the great empire of the Byzantines, successors of Rome, had been reduced to a tiny group of disunified, small rival states, surrounded by the new masters of all their old territory, the Ottoman Turks. Though now just a local city-state, Constantinople, reduced but still proud, clung to life for another two centuries. But ultimately, after a long siege and several other failed attempts, the city at last fell to the Ottomans in the year 1453. This was the decisive end of the Byzantine Empire, which had endured for nearly 1,000 years. The fall of their capital raised the threat level posed to Europe. The fragile continent now lived in the shadow of the Ottomans. But as ominous as the fall of Constantinople was, it was also to be Europe's saving grace. You may have noticed that we're how far into the episode now and haven't even talked about the Renaissance yet? Well, in addition to needing to give the Byzantines and the medieval Muslims a little airtime, the fall of Constantinople was one of those pivotal, world-changing events that is regarded as one of the most important in history. The Renaissance was driven in large part by the flood of refugees from Constantinople, including many Greek scholars who brought with them knowledge of ancient Greek language and lore. In other words, if Constantinople had never fallen, these classical texts and ideas might never have made their way into Europe, and the Renaissance might never have happened. Refugees bring their culture, and everyone benefits. Among the escapees of Constantinople were humanists, poets, writers, astronomers, musicians, philosophers, architects, scientists, and all kinds of other thinkers. Among them, the complete works of Plato and Aristotle, available for the first time in the West after having been only accessible previously through Arab commentaries. For the first time after the fall of the Byzantine Empire, Italian humanists could study the work of these philosophers under the guidance of the new migrants. The manuscripts and the commentaries on Aristotle showed the Italians a new side of the great thinker, one which hadn't been available to them before. They learned that Aristotle emphasized the role of empirical study and investigation, and that experiments were necessary to establish the truth. The Aristotelian emphasis on practical knowledge encouraged many Italian scholars to adapt a greater emphasis on observation and scientific experiment, paving the way for a scientific revolution that was to come. Other developments within Europe itself also helped set the stage for the Renaissance, much of which we covered last episode. Recall how the Crusades opened Europe up to the Eastern world once again, and also how the late Middle Ages was a series of catastrophes for them. Famine, the Black Death, the Hundred Years' War all wiped out a sizable chunk of the population and turned the European economy on its head. In a pleasant twist to history, these disasters ultimately helped establish the Renaissance, or at least created the right conditions in which it could thrive. The survivors of the late medieval Malthusian gauntlet, especially landed peasants and a new middle-ish class, ended up much wealthier, better fed, and more likely to stimulate trade, buying luxury goods and foods. Trade brought prosperity, and capitalism helped to lift people out of poverty. Additionally, it was during those tumultuous and death-filled periods that the earliest Renaissance figures, like Dante and Petrarch, lived. And we see the first of many developments in art to come. Remember that hard dates in history are tacked on by historians only after the fact, and that there's much more overlap between eras and societies than we imagine today. So when you're thinking about the beginnings of the Renaissance, you have to reach back further into the Middle Ages. The two not-so-separate cultures are so interwoven as to be indistinguishable at times. So let's backtrack a bit to the 1300s, when northern Italy, devastated by the plague, was divided into several warring city-states. While contenders on their own turf, the most powerful cities of Milan, Florence, Pisa, Genoa, Ferrara, and Venice all lived in the shadow of the greater struggle, the long battle for supremacy of the region between the papacy and the Holy Roman Empire, with each city allying itself with one faction or the other. War between the states and invasion from the outside were both common. This was the background in which the Renaissance developed. The first stirrings were in the written word. Only recently had Italian authors begun writing in their native tongue, rather than in Latin or French. These vernacular works, especially poetry, grew immensely popular with the literate, and revolutionized Italian literature decades before the Renaissance even got going. Even before the flood of texts from Constantinople, the new wave Italian writers were emulating the ancient Greeks and Romans, particularly Homer, Cicero, Virgil, and Aristotle, but in their own native language, and the people ate it up. This is where and when Dante wrote the Divine Comedy, surely today the most famous work of medieval literature period. Slightly less known to non-history buffs, but even more important to the era, was Francesco Petrarch, who in addition to being an accomplished writer and poet, was the founder of the key philosophy to shape the Renaissance. That philosophy is humanism. Petrarch saw the centuries of history which preceded him as being ignorant and barbaric, and is largely credited with inventing the idea of a Dark Ages. He rejected the Church's vision of life and the world, of man being sinful and inherently in need of redemption, of the body on earth being immaterial, and the mystical human soul and afterlife being the most important, absolute reality. Instead, humanism, well, it believes in humans, in man himself and the world he lives in. Humanism says that people are inherently rational, conscious, and basically good by nature, able to reason and think for themselves. This philosophy was radical at the time. It made people question their reality, question God, and worst of all, question the priests and the church. Actually, even the clergy got in on it, though. Yes, the popes of the Renaissance, too, were humanists, in their way. Many were despotic, sometimes insane egomaniacs. Go read about Pope Julius II, for instance. But that's because they did it their way, lived their best papal lives, leading troops in battle, conquering and controlling territory, and, most significant to us today, paying the bill for and commissioning more works of art and architecture than anybody else. These works were meant for the prestige and glory of each particular pope who ordered them and the church, but ended up as lasting monuments to humanism and secular culture. That's right, despite Renaissance culture's opposition to Catholic values, we have the Catholic Church to thank for much of Renaissance culture. Wow, thank you, history, for always being so clear-cut and easy to understand. If you really want to sum up what the Renaissance was, to say what happened and why it's important, say that it was about new ideas overthrowing old ones, and the changes that came thereafter. Once and for all, humanism overthrew feudalism, which had already been mortally weakened by the crisis of the late Middle Ages, and was now left in the dust by prominent scholars for a more optimistic and benevolent outlook. Therefore, because of the importance of ideas, the final cause of the Renaissance we need to mention is the arrival of movable type and printing presses in Europe. The widespread printing and dissemination of texts, both old and new, enabled more poor and middle-class people to learn to read. Normal people could now understand new ideas and become educated, challenging those in power. Once in that position, they didn't have to depend on their local priests as much anymore. They could think for themselves. And when you're thinking for yourself, humanism looks pretty good. But the printing press changed the nature of what a cookbook was as well. The printing revolution meant that knowledge of all manner of subjects was written, published, and disseminated, mass-produced, if you will, on a Renaissance scale. Food and cooking being no exception. By the 1500s, multiple works had been printed regarding foodstuffs, cooking, organization of kitchens, and meals. Detailed recipes and chef's manuals. This seems to have changed the way people thought about food. Just like in other subjects, you can draw a line between the culinary sources that were more late medieval and those that were distinctly modern. It was Renaissance cooks and food writers who invented the modern cookbook as we know it now. Across Europe, recipe collections had already been compiled for centuries before, but those recipes were of a more ancient character, bare bones memoranda without many quantities or details given. Abbreviating and relying on a cook's previous knowledge was the norm. These were more often for ceremonial purposes than for a practical cooking guide, preserving record of an important person's daily life in brief for posterity. But early modern chefs in the Renaissance, perhaps more experimentally minded in the light of classical knowledge, began to record recipes in much more detail, increasing scientific knowledge about cooking. They were curious about foodstuffs available locally and also elsewhere, and how people prepared them differently. In their writings, they also try to capture nuance and give clear instructions how to prepare a perfect meal. They were writing for the love of food, in other words. But the printing of codified recipe texts, with multiple copies distributed across the continent, was to have even bigger consequences beyond the dinner table. It led to some degree of standardization in national cuisine, giving people cultural identity that was broader than their hometown or county. Nations as we know them today had not yet officially formed in Europe, but many of the characteristics that defined national cuisine did, meaning that, as usual, cuisine was far ahead of politics, or maybe even shaped the politics of how the nations would eventually form. And so, at last, that is all, I think, the relevant background information to the Italian Renaissance, the rebirth of Europe, best known for the greatest hits cultural achievements of figures like Petrarch, Machiavelli, Michelangelo, Da Vinci, Raphael, Copernicus and Galileo, and many, many others. What began in Italy would spread north into the rest of Europe as the years went on, changing ideas and culture across the continent. It was not only culture which expanded in Italy, but wealth. The economy grew dramatically as the population grew. Trade increased, and the Italian city-states became the bank of Europe, using that money to finance long-distance trade expeditions and make even more money, which of course could be used to finance art and cultural works. Commercialism and capitalism's humble origins, as European merchants and businessmen got richer and richer. It's important to note, however, that that wasn't the case for everyone. Actually, it turns out it wasn't the case for almost anyone. The cultural and economic explosion of the Renaissance, turns out, affected relatively few people's daily lives. I have a little bit more to say about that, but I think we've waited long enough for the main course, and nobody likes a chef that keeps you waiting. So even though it took longer to get here than normal, let's talk about how and what people were eating during the era of the Renaissance. In short, we mostly see a continuation of all the trends we covered in the late medieval era last episode. The spices and the other foreign ingredients, the stews and pottages, roasts and sauces. But those elements, while familiar, weren't stagnant. They continued to evolve. The food in this era very much echoes earlier cooking and older recipes, but usually with significant modification. Modernized, if you will. In the early Renaissance, cooks were still very much following ancient physicians and the humoral diet, trying to balance foods against individual humors and temperaments. Hot and cold, moist and dry foods, properly nourishing the blood and the bile in our bodies. But for the nobility trying to show their wealth through food and banquets, this approach increasingly fell out of favor in later days, as exotic tastes became more available and their humoral quality ignored. By the 16th century, most cooks were less familiar with what foods affected which humors and all that, more focused on flavor and presentation. Interestingly enough, though, humoral-driven cooking had already shaped the tastes of early modern European eaters, with many customs and preparations left over, but now gastronomically preferred. For example, an earlier medieval cook, in order to not induce phlegmatic humors into a person, would never boil a fish as they would most other foods, but instead roast or grill it over open heat, and then dress it with spices that were thought to be warm and dry in nature to balance it. And by the time of the Renaissance, people still ate fish this way. I mean, that tracks, right? I grill fish similarly all the time. Using spices to coat it and then blasting it with heat results in blackened, char-grilled flavor. Humorally balanced or not, that's just delicious. The new merchant and artisan elite of the Renaissance loved eating well and admired the master cook with a vast knowledge of foodstuffs, their locations and seasonal availability, and how to best prepare them. Keep in mind, though, that they still conform to Christian rules about eating, further distinguishing their repertoires of regular feasting-type foods from lean, fasting foods. On most days, the average wealthy family would eat two meals, the main pranzo around midday, and then a lighter and simpler cena at nightfall. Snacks and bites could be taken before, after, or in between these meals, and a whole other category, a third meal termed colazioni, referred to finger foods, taken informally off a sideboard or credenza. Cooks further divided all dishes they made into two categories, kitchen foods and credenza foods, which grew in importance over time. The credenza slowly became central to Renaissance dining halls and meals, and the relevance of this antipasto, charcuterie, whatever you want to call it from wherever you are, never went away in European cuisine. It's still very much going strong today. The clients of Renaissance chefs enjoyed greater variety in their diets than ever before. Through bigger, more numerous, and more far-flung commercial networks than had ever been reached, overall, dishes seemed to get richer as a result. Sugar, increasingly available as trade flourished, is still considered healthy in this time, and put in everything. Another contribution to the rich palates was that dairy overall was being used more and more to thicken and enrichen fillings, sauces, and stews. Butter was the preferred cooking medium overall, and cheese, both fresh and aged, finds its way into so many recipes. As you might expect, Parmesan was a common favorite. The herb and spice cabinet grew and evolved as well. The Italians have always loved enriching dishes with a wide range of herbs. Sage, marjoram, mint, parsley, juniper leaves, oregano, poppy, bay leaves, clover, dill, sorrel, spinach, rocket, and even flower petals. There's cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves still dominating the dry spices, and somewhat surprisingly though, ginger and black pepper, both immensely popular in medieval cooking, fell out of vogue on the aristocratic palate by the 15th century. Bread and wine were still the common denominator across social classes. You know this by now, right? Poor people ate multigrain breads, and rich people ate soft, finer white breads. And everybody ate sops. Grapevines, as you probably know as well, grow quite well all over Italy, and even peasants could make their own wine. Some common grapes of that era include Prosecco, Lambrusco, Albano, and Chianti, still with us today. Wine was always diluted with water, Greek style, or ice, and could often be flavored with spices. Verjuice, the liquid from unripe pressed grapes, was still a very common acidic ingredient used to give dishes tartness. For these reasons, grapes were probably the most popular fruit to grow, but other contenders included cherries, dates, figs, mull and strawberries, apples, apricots, peaches, and plums. As for veggies, among European staples like the brassicas, gourds, turnips, onions, and leeks, vegetables that had previously been novelties like artichokes, asparagus, carrots, eggplants, endives, parsnips, rhubarb, and licorice root were now common in early modern cookery. Don't forget, though, that tomatoes are still unknown, and then unrecognized for many years even after Europe discovered the Americas in 1492, but I'm getting ahead of myself again. Focus, Anthrochef, focus. Pies and pastries improved over their medieval counterparts, too. Increasingly, a distinction was being made between the old sorts of crusts, multiple centimeters thick, made solely to contain a mixture of ingredients before being discarded, and then a newer, thinner style that was not only edible, but appealing. Part of the development of this thin, edible pie shell has to do with the rise of pasta in Italian cooking. As we said earlier, pasta was immensely popular and used in all sorts of ways more creative than we're probably used to today. Its sheets were stretched out thin and used in a more dough and pastry type capacity. I feel like this must have led to the aha moment that allowed the same logic to apply to pie crusts. But pasta took on a whole other life of its own. Prepared either moist or dry, boiled in water, broth, or milk, or fried in oil, stuffed pasta, pasta turnovers, and pies and tartlets, gnocchi, lasagna, macaroni, ravioli, tortellini, tagliatelle, orecchietti, vernicelli, all here in Renaissance Italy and still popular today. Common fillings included cheese, butters, and oils, but also spices, herbs, and fatty meats. No marinara sauce, that's for sure. As for what proteins people ate, pork was still number one, as it was in the earliest days of the Middle Ages too. This is not just because of the ease and economic viability of raising pigs, but also because of how many uses its various parts can be put to, and how readily it was salted and preserved into cured delights like prosciutto and guanciale and so many others. But if pork dominated, sheep and mutton meat might have been a close second, especially when it came to fresh meat. And I feel like it goes without saying at this point in almost any episode that seafood, fish, and various crustaceans and aquatic animals were essential to the Renaissance diet, both rich and poor. A good chef was expected to be familiar with all manner of them, from every corner of the sea and land. Most people dined at home with friends and family, but there were plenty of options for public eating for travelers or the urban poor without cooking hearths. Markets were full of vendors selling snacks and small bites, but there were also inns and wine shops. One of these so-named osterias, the Osteria del Sole, opened in 1465 in Bologna, and is still open today, functioning much as it did 500 years ago. It's not BYOB, but BYOF. People bring their own food, and the osteria provides the wine to go with it. Nice. While the overall character of cuisine didn't change all that much from medieval to early modern Europe, everything about dining did become more refined. Little by little, the old medieval communitarianism, which ensured that masters provided food for their servants and lessers, was being left behind. The practices of lords dining with their vassals had also largely faded away, replaced by exclusive courts and private parties. An exhausting amount of table manners developed and came into play for these wealthy diners. Manners were a way for those wealthy classes to reassert the social order that they lost in the Middle Ages, distinguishing themselves from everybody else by how they behaved at the table. Table manners and customs had, of course, existed in other societies for millennia. But this movement was a little different. This was a collective search for meaning by the aristocratic classes via standardization, something that could bind them all together and make them better than everybody else. As such, it got more and more elaborate to the point where even eating with one's fingers was starting to be looked down upon for the first time in Western history. Though forks would still not catch on for a few hundred years more, all sorts of other dining utensils and individual cutlery were introduced. Napkins became a big deal to the upper classes to protect their fine-woven, maybe imported tablecloths. Guests had to show that they knew how to use them properly by placing them on their left shoulder as etiquette required. Table manners ended up shaping people's dining spaces as well. Throughout the medieval period, dining had simply taken place wherever the boards had been set up into a table, hence the phrase set the table. But by the late 1400s, the designation of a specific room for eating began to take shape in the minds of those who could afford it. This was effectively when the modern concept of the dining room was invented. Rich households contained increasingly elaborate ones, with gorgeous painted ceilings and easy access for waiters to and from the kitchen. Alfresco dining and outdoor spaces grew popular as well, as many designs incorporated gardens or other beautiful locations into their dining spaces. Central to people's dining spaces, both indoor and outdoor, was the aforementioned credenza, or sideboard, where the cold foods for the table were kept to be served anytime. The credenza also held elaborate plates that helped demonstrate the wealth of the host. The credenza became so important that you'll often see it depicted in paintings, or painted in the scenes on the walls and ceilings around the credenza. Dining rooms were also decorated with sugar sculptures. Yeah, you heard that right, statues and scenes literally made out of sugar. Depictions of an elephant with a castle on its back, or Hercules slashing at the mouth of a lion, a camel with a dark king above, and a unicorn with its horn in the mouth of a serpent. Sculptures were usually made from a paste of sugar, water, and gum. Sugar paste used in the Renaissance period is comparable to wedding cake fondant we see today. So this is sort of the birth of all those inedible display cakes you see in bakeries and on TV today. Yay! Banquets would have had buffoons, jesters, dancers, acrobats, and musicians, maybe even the occasional fireworks imported from China. But the delivery of the food itself was often part of the meal's entertainment as well. Serving tables on wheels, pulled by two jaguars, for instance, or birds flying out of a pie, yes, that was a real thing. Meat carvers, in particular, were something of a weird hybrid between chefs, entertainers, and knights? The Trinquianti, as he was called, was a master swordsman with his own titles and lands. Being served by one was considered a high honor. Supposedly, a master Trinquianti could hew the meat in the air and have it fall perfectly carved onto the plate. A really big feast by a really wealthy benefactor might have multiple of these guys serving up cuts of all sorts. Which, speaking of, I have been feeling a bit burned out in my current day job. Maybe it's time to think about a career change and bring back the Trinquianti profession. So I think we've rounded out a pretty broad basic tour of the Renaissance and its cuisine. How did this era end? Or did it end at all? In some ways, the Renaissance continued as it evolved into other things and progressed into the age of enlightenment, science, and exploration. But in other ways, it very much did end, though the end is just as hard to pinpoint as the beginning. The end of the 15th century was tumultuous. By then, the church was fighting back against the humanist tide, decrying Renaissance culture as vain and indulgent. A monk named Savonarola rode that backlash against secularism to power in Florence, where he oversaw the famous Bonfire of the Vanities, where many precious works of art and literature were burned away from history. Books were banned, religious fear was on the rise. Many see this movement as the end of the Renaissance. But to make things even crazier in northern Italy, a series of invasions by French, Spanish, and German troops totally destabilized the region. Rome was sacked, and the role of the papacy as the biggest patron of the arts and architecture was ended. But as the Renaissance petered out in Italy, its tendrils had spread out and begun to flourish elsewhere. The Northern Renaissance in France, the Netherlands, and then Britain, and then the rest of Northern Europe too, adopted many ideals and styles of the Italian Renaissance, and continued its traditions another 200 years directly into the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution. The spread north of Renaissance culture was actually part of a much larger trend on the world stage. The Mediterranean, that great sea which had been the center of civilization and world geopolitics since the beginning of history, was becoming no longer as such. Recently invented ocean-going vessels and newly discovered trade routes shifted power to the port cities on the Atlantic Ocean, Lisbon, Seville, and London. The age of exploration had, for now, quietly begun. But that's definitely a story for another episode, or probably episodes. Many scholars believe that way too much gravitas is given to this capital R Renaissance, as I call it, and I'm inclined to agree with them. Yeah, let me just pull the rug out from under this whole thing right at the end. Don't get me wrong, the Renaissance has always been one of my favorite eras of history to learn about. I admire humanism, and I think it was an important development in Western thought. But urban philosophical revolutions didn't matter all that much to the 3/4 of the people who still live their lives as rural peasants. For the majority of the population, in other words, life was basically unchanged from the Middle Ages. Classical feudalism had actually never been common in northern Italy, where most peasants worked private farms and continued to throughout and after the Renaissance. Some historians even argue that there's an increase in feudalization and serfdom in the later Renaissance, as the new merchant humanist elites turned themselves into landed aristocrat nobles, driving Europe overall back towards inequality. Again, in northern Italy, the most urbanized area in all Europe, the Renaissance was very much real. But even there, while there was a decent-sized class of artisans and skilled workers who lived comfortable lives, most people belonged to the unskilled worker class and the urban poor, living job to job and meal to meal. The Renaissance had little effect on them. So what can we conclude, with the Renaissance actually being such a niche movement? It wasn't really a period of great social or economic change, outside of a small few. Those large-scale transformations already happened during the Middle Ages. Instead, the Renaissance was a flourishing of ideas. That achievement and the cultural works generated from it hold great prestige in hindsight, but just weren't relevant to most daily life at the time. That's why many historians prefer not to call this era the Renaissance at all, but rather the much more benign early modern Europe. Wow, thank you for sticking with me through this whirlwind of an episode. I'm sure it couldn't have been easy to follow along with me rambling between the Muslims and the Byzantines and then somehow into the Renaissance. I hope it all fit together for you, at least a little bit. I won't keep you much longer. I'll just say, like always, please leave a review if you liked the episode, and don't forget to visit anthrochef.blog for recipes. See you next time. Thanks for listening.